The story Forget-Me-Not was written by Joe McHugh and is read by Joanne Phillips, with music by Joe and Paula McHugh and Forrest Newton.
Forget-Me-Not.
"I've always said Emma was big-hearted," whispered the tall woman under the wide-brimmed hat to the shorter woman standing next to her. "I mean, the way she went and married Walter, even after that terrible accident. Few women would have done a thing like that." The shorter woman nodded, encouraging the born talker to continue. "Why, she could have broken off the engagement. Not a soul in Phelps Mill would have uttered a word against her." "He needed looking after," the short woman said. "I'll say he did, but that's work for a hired girl, not a young wife." The tall woman sighed and gazed into the distance. "But I reckon Emmy had her reasons." Her companion was about to say it was because of love, but was hushed by the preacher, who opened his carrying around Bible and cleared his throat. "My brothers and sisters in Christ, we are gathered here today in the sight of God to bid farewell to Emma Hendricks. Let us pray. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures." Thus was Aunt Emma laid to rest in a small country cemetery under the leafy branches of a 100-year-old sugar maple, while cicadas sang in the summer grass. Walter sat in his wheelchair at the edge of the grave, with a bouquet of flowers on his lap that he had cut that morning from the garden. He laid them on top of the coffin after the prayer was finished and before Emma was lowered into the ground to await the day of judgment. His face betrayed no trace of the emotions roiling inside him, reluctant to say goodbye to his best friend and constant companion, his comforter and confessor. Circling the grave were several dozen men and women. Most came from the surrounding farms, but a few, like Hank Ogren, were from town. Hank was president of the Farmers Trust Bank, and he had driven out to Phelps Mill in his brand-new 1934 Essex Terraplane. Standing next to Hank were Judge Kyle Mannington and his wife Elsie. It didn't matter who you asked, rich or poor. Aunt Emma was loved and respected and would be missed. Emma Starr met Walter Hendricks at a dance in 1890 when she was 20 years old. Walter was a strong, good-looking boy with bright blue eyes and an easy laugh. 2 months later, they got engaged. But then Walter had his accident. He was skidding saw logs out of the woods, driving a team of percherons, when a log broke loose and rolled down on top of him, crushing both his legs. That he survived the accident at all was considered something of a miracle. He nearly bled to death in the back of Bob Durbin's wagon on the way to Doc Mooney's. The old doc did his best to save the legs, but when gangrene set in several days later, he was forced to amputate, removing each leg just above the knee. Emma stayed by Walter's side throughout this whole horrific ordeal, even though he repeatedly offered to release her from her promise to be his wife. "For better or for worse," she told him when the subject came up. "That's what the vows say." "But you haven't said the vows, and I'm now a broken man, Emmy. I can't give you the life you deserve." "The body is broken, not the man. We'll manage somehow. God will watch over us." So they were married. Walter's father bought them a house as a wedding present. It came with a large vegetable garden and 4 cleared acres, enough for a brood of chickens and a mob of pigs. Emma's family did their part as well. Her father was a county commissioner, and when the position of postmaster for Phelps Mill came open, he saw to it that his new son-in-law got the job. Emma and Walter turned the front room of their house into a combination post office and general store, and settled into their new life together, the days coming like heartbeats, one after another. Now it's said that misfortune and blessings are two buckets drawn from the same well, and so it was for Walter. Before the accident, he was an active man, a hard worker and a good dancer. Now confined to a wheelchair, he often suffered bouts of depression, which worried Emma, so she did what she could to cheer him up. On their second Christmas together, she handed him a large box wrapped in brown paper and a golden ribbon. "What's in this box, Emmy?" Walter asked. "It's half as big as you." "Well, why not open it and find out?" He untied the ribbon and tore the paper away to reveal a leather-covered violin case. Lifting the lid, he found a beautiful violin with a bow made from Brazil wood and wrapped with silver wire. "Everett got it off a Frenchman in Baltimore," Emma said. Everett was her older brother. All five of her siblings had names that started with the letter E, and Everett worked as a superintendent for the railroad. "The Frenchie was a sailor," Emma continued. "He got tangled up with the law and needed cash money quick, and Everett came away with the fiddle."
"What did it cost him?"
"He wouldn't say, but he allowed it would cost me a half dozen eggs a week for a year." Emma laughed, and Walter couldn't tell if she was joking or not. "No, really," he said. "This violin must have cost plenty." "Stop thinking about money for once," Emma scolded. "Flip it over and look at the back. Everett says it's made with flame maple. Hold it up to the light. See? Don't it look just like fire?"
"It sure is nice, Emmy."
"Didn't you tell me once that when you were a boy you wanted to learn to play the fiddle?"
"I did, but my mother wouldn't allow one in the house."
"Why in the world not?"
"Because she's a Baptist, and the fiddle is used for dancing and carrying on."
"But your Uncle Luke played the fiddle. And what about your father's cousin over in Kentucky? What's his name? Doesn't he play the fiddle?"
"Uncle Ambrose. He did, until he had a stroke."
"Well, then, maybe music-making is in your blood. But won't me learning to play this thing drive you away? It's sure to sound like a sack full of scalded cats."
"I can stand it if it keeps you from moping."
And it turned out that Emma was right about music being in Walter's blood. In practically no time, he could play his way through "Jump Jim Crow" and "West Fork Girls" and "Going Down to Georgia O." He spent hours each day practicing and learning little tricks, like plunking the E string with his pinky finger while playing "Too Young to Marry," or bouncing his bow from string to string as he played "Drunken Hiccups." The fiddle became a source of great pleasure for him and Emma both. Emma loved to garden, and she made the rows extra wide so Walter could keep her company in his wheelchair. He liked to play his fiddle for her while she hoed corn and picked beans. Sometimes Emma sang along with the tunes, a practice called lilting that she had picked up from her Irish grandfather. One bright blue spring day, after they had been married a score of years, a professional photographer showed up at the store. He drove a two-horse wagon with a large enclosed box on the back, the kind medicine show fellows traveled the country with. But instead of bottles of Hostetter's Celebrated Stomach Bitters and boxes of mile-toe corn and bunion plasters containing 20% cannabis indica, his wagon contained box cameras, gangly tripods, and magnesium flash pans. It also served as his darkroom for developing his pictures.
"My name is Artemus Brown," the man introduced himself to Walter, who was minding the store. "I was hoping you could tell me if anyone hereabouts might be interested in having their portraits taken. I've been trained by some of the best photographers in Philadelphia and New York, and I know my business, if I do say so myself."
He was a short, compact man with a chin-strap beard and a hefty gold watch chain that dangled from one vest pocket to another. There was something about the way he talked that made Walter grin. "The Mortensons are a vain bunch," Walter told him. "They live a ways up on Finger Lick."
"You don't have to be vain to want to have your picture taken," the man said.
"You're right there," Walter said, and then an idea popped into his head. "I'll tell you what. If I find you some folks willing to pay to have their pictures made, would you give me a discount on a photograph of my wife?"
"That seems fair to me. We've all got to help each other if we hope to get through this troublesome world without getting too banged up. But I've got to warn you, my wife's so pretty she might break your camera.
No worry there, mister, the man said with a laugh. I have a special lens for extra pretty women. Emma, sorting mail, overheard this exchange, and she turned her face away so the stranger wouldn't see her blush. Walter can be so dang sweet, she thought to herself, and made up for all the hard work and looking after. Several days later, Mr. Brown stopped by the store with Emma's photograph and to say goodbye. He had photographed 11 families, a team of horses, a prize-winning hog, and a corpse, this last belonging to Ned Barber, who died of a busted appendix. The photograph made Walter as happy as a dog wagging two tails, and he ordered an oval gilt frame from a company in Cincinnati. When it came, he hung Emma's picture with pride on their sitting room wall. Now, Emma was gone, and Walter was an old man on his own. He decided to keep the store and post office going, but he was lonely and often played his fiddle late into the night when he couldn't fall asleep. About this time, the Penaflex Company began work on a natural gas pipeline that would pass through the north end of the county. The foreman of the Penaflex crew was an accomplished fiddler named Jimmy Reeves. On Saturday nights, he would show up at the local dance hall, decked out in custom-made alligator skin boots, a white satin shirt with snap buttons, and a pearl-gray Stetson. "You boys mind if I join in?" he would ask the band leader. And more times than not, the leader would invite him up on stage, and he would play with such force that the notes fairly jumped out of his fiddle. Of course, this excited the dancers, and they twirled faster and kicked their heels up higher, and soon Reeves would be right up in front, closest one to the microphone, crowding the other fiddlers off to the side. And that is exactly how the foreman wanted it. He liked being top dog with his fiddle tucked tight and neat under his chin, and all the pretty girls giving him the eye. One night, Reeves showed up at a dance at Disciples of Christ Church at the mouth of Willow Run, not far from Phelps Mill. Walter Hendricks was the lead fiddler that night, and they had an extra microphone set low so he could play while seated in his wheelchair. Reeves had never seen such an arrangement before, and he held back and listened for a while. Bold as he was, Reeves was impressed by the old man's style of fiddling. But what most impressed him was the fetching sound of Walter's violin, the one Emma's brother had gotten off the Frenchman. To Reeves' ear, it had an exceptionally sweet tone, yet it was loud enough to be heard over the other instruments, even the piano. He realized it was the fiddle he had been looking for all his life. "Would you mind if I gave your fiddle a try?" he said to Walter while the band was taking a break and the dancers had stepped outside to cool down. "You play the fiddle?" Walter was always delighted to meet a fellow musician. "I've been known to rosin the bow from time to time." Walter handed the fiddle up to him. "Well, give her a try." Reeves worked his way through a breakdown, and the violin sounded as good close under his ear as it had from across the room, which wasn't always the case. "What do you call that tune?" Walter asked. "Smith's Reel." "That's a Missouri tune, ain't it?" "I grew up in Missouri, down in the Ozarks." "Play one more. I like what you can do with a fiddle." So Reeves launched into his version of Lost Indian and played it through twice while other members of the band nodded and smiled. Then he handed the fiddle back to Walter. "That is a mighty fine instrument," Reeves said. "You know, a man would pay a good price for a violin like that." Walter smiled. "No amount of money can separate me from this fiddle, mister. It was a gift from my dear departed wife. She raised eggs for a year to pay for it." "Eggs," Reeves said, but Walter just laughed, which made the foreman chafe. "But I'm talking about real cash money. Look, these are hard times, and everyone can use a little money." "I could use more than a little," Walter said with a chuckle, thinking about how little he made from the store and post office. The trouble was, he found it difficult to say no to people. They would feed him a hard luck story and ask for credit, just for a month or two, you know, until they could get back on their feet again, or until the baby came, or their son sent them some money from Omaha, where he'd found work in the stockyards. Walter would write the amount down next to their names in his book and let them carry the food, shoes, and seed corn out of his store, knowing he would likely never see a penny for it. But what else could he do? These were his neighbors, his friends. If only the big money men would let Mr. Roosevelt turn things around. That's what he prayed for. Reeves waited a couple of days before visiting the store to work on Walter some more. His lust for the violin had taken possession of him, and he wasn't the kind of person to let anyone or anything stand in the way of what he wanted. "Here's $240 cash," Reeves said, peeling off 24 $10 bills and laying them on the counter, one after the other, for effect. Walter wheeled his chair up close, gazed at the money, and sighed. "Oh, don't reckon I've seen that many sawbucks in one stack for I don't know how long. But look here, Reeves." He spun the chair around to face the foreman. "I'm not in the market to sell. There are plenty more good violins in the world. I'll just keep the one I have." It came to Reeves then that the old man would not be moved by money or any other enticement. The foreman would have to come up with an alternative plan. Several days later, Reeves was shooting eight ball at Skinner's pool hall with a crowd of the town loafers when he struck up a conversation with a young buck named Eddie Townsend, Walter Hendricks' nephew. As a foreman who hired and fired men as a matter of course, Reeves had become a pretty good judge of character over the years. He took in the young man's slothful manner, the way his eyes darted with worry to the door whenever it opened, like he owed money, and the way after a couple of beers, which Reeves gladly paid for, Ed bragged how he wasn't afraid of the police or anybody else. "Yep," Reeves thought to himself, "he's just the fellow I'm looking for." And he saw no reason to waste time going all the way around the barn to get to the point. "Look here, Eddie. You seem to be a bright young fellow, and I'm going to be square with you. Your uncle has a violin that I'd give my eye teeth to own. You know the one I'm talking about?" Ed nodded. "It's got as pretty a maple back as you could hope to find. It's like that fiddle's on fire." "Yep, that's the one. Well, I offered to buy the violin from your uncle. Hell, I offered twice what it's worth, but he turned me down. It left me discouraged, to tell you the truth. Uncle Walter can be a stubborn son of a bitch once his mind is set. Just how high are you willing to go to get that violin?" Reeves knew in that instant that even though Eddie was a layabout, he had a nose for opportunity. "I'd go as high as $300. Eddie scratched his chin and whistled. "Whew, that sure ain't pocket change, mister. A man could live for a year on that much money without doing a lick of work," the foreman pressed his opening. "Of course, I don't much care who gets the money, so long as I get the fiddle. We're about done with the pipeline and just in time, what with the cold weather coming in and snow on the way. I'll be leaving this old burg soon, and don't reckon I'll ever be back. Sure hate to leave without that violin, and the money still in my pocket." "Well," he shrugged, "I guess some things can't be helped. Let me buy you another beer and we'll shoot a game of pool." They racked up the balls and Reeves didn't mention the fiddle again. The next afternoon, when the foreman came into the pool hall, Eddie was ready for him. "You still wanting that fiddle?" he asked the older man, his voice lowered so as not to be overheard. "I'll tell a man I do," said Reeves. "And you ain't too particular about how it comes your way? That's not really my concern, is it? I'll give the money to any man who turns it over to me. Is the price still $300? Reeves nodded. "Let's take a little walk. I have an idea I want to talk over with you." They went down Hickory Street, past the feed store and the shoe repair shop, until they reached the old bridge that crossed the river to the railroad switching yard. But it wasn't until they started up the tracks that Eddie laid out his plan. "My uncle always goes to church of a Wednesday evening. Someone comes by the house and fetches him around 6 o'clock and takes him over and brings him back. So I'm thinking as tomorrow is Wednesday, maybe I'll hide myself in the woods across the road from his place, and after he's gone to church, I'll slip in and snatch the fiddle." Everything was going along as Reeves predicted it would with a man like Eddie, and yet he had to ask, "Don't it bother you none, stealing from your own kin?" Eddie stopped walking and looked at Reeves, the soles of his shoes grinding the cinders by the track as he turned and faced the bigger man. "I don't know as if I'd call it stealing. Ever since my aunt died, Uncle Walter ain't been the same. I doubt he'll last out the winter. My mother says it's like that when a husband and wife are very close. One dies, and pretty soon, before you know it, the other goes too. And what will happen to the fiddle then? It'll just get auctioned off for a few bucks with the rest of his belongings. That'd be an awful waste, as I see it." "From what I understand," Reeves put in, "your uncle never had any children. Maybe he left the fiddle to you in his will. Maybe he left you his house and everything else." Eddie sneered. "Me and my uncles ain't that close. We used to be, but we ain't no more." Reeves considered asking what caused the falling out, but he didn't really care. He was just glad young Eddie wasn't about to scruple the theft and sale of his uncle's violin. "Do you have a way to get over to your uncle's house tomorrow evening?" "I figured on walking," said Eddie. "No, I'll drive you over in my truck. Is there some place we can park on the other side of the woods?" "Yeah, sure. The woods come out on another road." "Good, then that's what we'll do. I'll have the money with me." "Pick me up in the back of the pool hall at 5 o'clock, Eddie said, showing some animation. "It'll be near dark by then, so nobody will see us go off together." That night brought the first snowfall of the winter, about 4 inches. By morning, the sky had cleared, and Reeves wound up the pipeline project, paid off the crew, and saw to the loading of the equipment. Just before 5 o'clock, he drove into town and turned into the alley that ran behind the pool hall. Eddie was standing outside in the cold, smoking a cigarette. He got into the truck, blowing on his hands to warm them up. "Head north out of town. It's about 3 miles. You got the money with you?" "Don't worry about the money," Reeves said, patting his stomach where he wore his money belt. "It's right here." Eddie pulled a short, flat bottle from his coat pocket. He unscrewed the cap and took a pull on it. The smell of cheap whiskey filled the cab of the truck. He held the bottle out to Reeves, but the foreman shook his head. "Suit yourself," Eddie said, and took another big swallow before stuffing the bottle back into his pocket. They drove on in silence for several miles, until Eddie spoke again. "Turn left here. This road'll bring us around the far side of the woods." "You're going to go through with this, right? And then keep mum?" Reeves was gauging the risk. Eddie was far from being his choice partner in crime. "Of course I am. I ain't no coward." "I wasn't saying you were. Just wanted to be sure." "When are you leaving town?" "Tomorrow sometime. I'll winter in Alabama. The company's got us scheduled to go to Illinois in the spring." "Good. If the sheriff starts nosing around looking for that fiddle, I want it long gone." Half a mile farther on, they began to skirt a wood that ran along the right side of the road. At Eddie's instruction, Reeves turned into an abandoned logging road and drove a short way into the trees. Reeves cut the engine, and Eddie jumped out. "This shouldn't take long. I'll get the fiddle as soon as my uncle leaves for church." "Did you bring a flashlight?" "Don't need one. The moon's already up, and with all this snow, I can see my way just fine." It was less than a third of a mile through the woods to the road that ran in front of Hendrick's store. Eddie sheltered just inside the tree line. He took occasional sips of whiskey and watched the smoke drift from his uncle's chimney into the frosty night air. There were half a dozen houses stretched up and down the road, but he saw no one moving about. Then he heard the sound of a truck coming down the road. It pulled up in front of the store with the engine running and the lights on. Two men got out and went in the front door, and a minute later they carried out his Uncle Walter. They lifted their passenger into the cab of the truck, tied the wheelchair to the flatbed, and drove off. Eddie wasted no time. As soon as the sound of the truck faded away, he slipped out of the woods and crossed the road in the moonlight. He snuck around the building to the back porch, half of which served as a woodshed. Instead of stairs leading from the ground to the porch, there was a wooden ramp with a sturdy handrail. Eddie climbed the ramp. The back door had a glass window, and even though Eddie knew there was a key on the ledge above the door, he wanted it to look like a burglary. The neighboring homes were far enough away that he didn't fear being heard. He picked up a chunk of wood and busted the window. He reached through, unlocked the door, and stepped into the kitchen. His uncle lived in several rooms separated from the store and post office, and Eddie pictured the layout in his mind. The kitchen led directly into a sitting room. To the right of the sitting room was a short hallway, wide enough for Walter's wheelchair, with a bedroom on one side and an office with a roll-top desk on the other side. At the end of the hallway was a bathroom fitted with cast-iron pipes, screwed to the walls so his uncle could use the toilet and lift himself in and out of the bathtub. Eddie paused a moment and listened. The only sound was the lazy crackle of the wood stove. He recalled that the old man kept the violin on a small round table in the sitting room, so he headed that way. Walter's sitting room was illuminated by the moonlight that streamed in through the side window. On the wall near the wood stove was a large, oval, gilt-edged picture frame. Inside the frame was a photograph of his late aunt. The sight of his aunt filled the young intruder with a rush of memories. Whereas his uncle could be hard and unforgiving as flint, Aunt Emma was always warm and welcoming. She would give him something to eat whenever he came to visit and ask him questions. "What are you up to these days, Eddie? How do you like school? Do you have a girlfriend yet?" No one else ever asked him about his life, not his parents, who had too many kids and too little money to pay much attention. Nor did Uncle Walter, or any of the other relatives for that matter. But Aunt Emma made him feel as if she was genuinely interested, and Eddie suddenly missed her kindly ways. Now, with Emma peering down at him from the oval picture frame, Eddie felt small and mean. He sensed her presence in the house, as if she were still alive and might walk in from the kitchen at any moment. He even imagined he detected the scent of her perfume, and he knew she was disappointed in him. The shame burned his cheeks. Suddenly, he knew he couldn't go through with it. He couldn't violate the trust she had placed in him. He might have already thrown his soul away, but he'd be hanged if he'd sink to betraying his own flesh and blood. Turning on his heel, he hurried from the house, leaving the fiddle untouched in its case on the small round table. When he got back to the truck, he was cold, irritable, and winded. "Let's get out of here," he said, slamming the door. "Where's the fiddle?" Reeves asked, without touching the starter button. "There ain't going to be no goddamn fiddle." "What do you mean? Didn't your uncle go to church?" "Yeah, he went to church." "And was his fiddle in the house?" "Yeah, it was in the sitting room, like always." "Then why didn't you bring it back with you? You want the money, don't you?" Eddie's sulky manner was getting on Reeves' nerves, and he could feel his anger rising. "You can keep your money. I ain't going to rob the old man. It ain't right." "Well, this is a fine time to get religion," Reeves snorted. "You dragged me all the way out here and made me sit in a cold truck for the better part of an hour, expecting to get that fiddle, and by God, I aim to have it. Now you go back there and fetch it." Eddie made no move to get out of the truck, but instead dug around in his coat pocket for his bottle. "I said get moving, you worthless rounder. I'll not be trifled with." Startled by the anger and menace in the older man's voice, Eddie swung open the truck door and climbed out. "Hell, I'll just walk back to town." Reeves was seething. He was tempted to jump out of the truck and beat the crap out of Eddie, teach him a lesson. Of all the stupid stunts he had ever been party to. Instead, he just sat behind the steering wheel and watched Eddie walk away down the logging road, the young man's elbow lifting as he took another swig from his bottle. After a couple of minutes, Reeves reached under the truck seat and withdrew a .32 caliber nickel-plated revolver, which he dropped into his coat pocket. Grumbling to himself, "If you want something done right, you've got to do it yourself," he set off through the woods in the direction of the store, following Eddie's footsteps in the snow. He crossed the road and continued following the tracks around the back of the house to the porch. After climbing the ramp, he inspected the broken window before trying the doorknob. Eddie had not reset the lock. He stepped inside and passed through the kitchen into the moonlit sitting room. The fiddle case was on the table, and he went over to it. Grabbing it by the handle, he turned to confront the image of a woman in an oval picture frame staring down at him. For a moment, he was powerless to move his legs as a sickening wave of reproach and fear surged through him. It was a familiar feeling, one he experienced often as a boy, just before his father beat him with the razor strop. He felt the eyes in the portrait boring into his own. A light seemed to shimmer about the oval frame. His palms started to clam up and sweat. This was no mere photograph, he believed, but a living soul. A log burning in the stove slid down against the cast iron side, making a clang. Reeves struggled to calm his erratic breathing. He had a choice to make: set down the violin and flee the house, or master the irrational terror that threatened to unman him. "I fear you not, woman," he croaked. "Be you ghost or devil, and I'm taking this violin for my own, and you be damned." Reeves willed his legs to move, and he made for the back door. He slipped going down the icy ramp, but managed to regain his balance. Clutching the violin, he hurried across the road and entered the dark woods. All was still and quiet, except for the crunch of his boots in the snow. He struggled to gain control of his emotions, and it took some time before he realized that he had lost track of the footprints in the snow. He assumed he was walking in the general direction of the truck, but wasn't exactly sure where he was. "Stop fretting," he scolded himself, his breath clouding up in the frigid night air. "You'll find the road easy enough when you reach the other side of these woods." The moon shone down through the branches of the bare trees, casting long shadows across his snowy path. Crunch, 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 step after step. The air was breathless, the woods stark and empty. Then, through the cold silence, he thought he heard something. He stopped and listened. Faintly, from what seemed a great distance, he heard music. Perhaps someone in one of the houses near the store was playing the Victrola or the radio. He took a few more steps and stopped again. The music sounded closer. He looked among the trunks of the trees, but saw nothing. He trained his ears on the sound. It was a fiddle. He rubbed his dry lips with his free hand. No, it wasn't a fiddle. It was someone singing a fiddle tune, and it was coming closer. He was in a blue panic now, and his mind went back in time to when he and his mother would visit his grandmother at the state mental asylum in Weston. It was a terrifying place. He recalled one woman in particular. Dressed in a soiled nightgown, all she did was walk in circles and sing to herself, her hair matted and filthy. "Why is she singing, Mama?" he asked. "Her mind's wandering," was all his mother would say. Reeves started off again, picking up his pace so that the crunching of his boots drowned out the singing for a while. But then he heard it again, louder and closer, as if someone were stalking him. Terror now gripped him, and he started to run, kicking up snow with each step. Several times he stumbled and dropped to his knees, cursing, looking back over his shoulder, straining to catch sight of his pursuer. His breath came in sharp, painful stabs. The woods were endless. The singer was close. Very close. Just behind him. Reeves halted, panting and exhausted. The knees of his trousers were soaked, and the cold and exertion made his lungs hurt. A sudden, desperate anger blazed up in him, and he swung around to confront his tormentor. To free his right hand, he dropped the fiddle case, the thump muffled by the snow. He drew his revolver from his pocket. 6 pistol shots exploded and echoed through the dark, empty woods, startling the night creatures, only for the echoes to be swallowed up again by the winter stillness. The next morning was crisp and bright when Glenn Martin, a local trapper, came upon a dead man in the snow. He went and fetched the sheriff. The deceased was identified as one James Arthur Reeves, foreman for a construction company that had just completed a pipeline through the county. Reeves was found lying on his back, an empty revolver clutched in his right hand. During the autopsy, the coroner found no indication of any external wound. Neither did he find evidence of heart attack or stroke. In the end, he filled in the certificate with the words, "Death from exposure." There was another part to this strange occurrence that baffled the authorities. In the snow next to the dead man, the sheriff found the distinct imprint of a fiddle case, but no instrument was recovered from the scene. There were two sets of footprints, those of the dead man and the trapper who found him, but no sign of anyone else ever having been there. So what had happened to the fiddle case? Len Martin was known to be an honest man, and he swore he never touched it. He swore he never even saw it. And no one else could explain what happened. Walter Hendricks returned from church that evening to find the window of his back door broken, pieces of glass scattered on the kitchen floor. He suspected a robbery, but after a thorough search he found nothing missing. He went to bed planning to call the sheriff in the morning. Early the next day, however, everyone was talking about the dead man found in the woods, and Walter wondered if he had anything to do with his broken window. He made one more search and discovered something unusual. The doily that covered the round table in the sitting room where he kept his fiddle was damp. He couldn't understand why. The bottom of the fiddle case felt damp as well. He looked up at Emma's portrait. "Do you know what's going on here?" he asked. There was no reply. Walter shrugged and put the mystery out of his mind. Later that evening, as was his custom before turning in, he opened the case and took out his fiddle. He wheeled his chair around so he could look at Emma's portrait as he played her favorite tune. It was a waltz titled, "Forget Me Not."